My heart is still in Gaza. The Israelis want to make Gaza uninhabitable.
Yet the West remains largely silent to the cries of Gaza.
It burns right through and it continues to burn. You have to cut it out. It's the difference between a flood and a tsunami.
Really?
The magnitude, the scale, the intensity.
We can't allow those who advocate for genocide, we can't allow them our vote.
Had the Israelis killed 10,000 French or Swiss or Ukrainian or British children, would the reaction have been the same? All of this perfect storm is almost like a medieval attempt through starvation and epidemics to wipe out the population. Where the bombs and the bullets don't get you, the disease will surely get you. It is because they are the children of a lesser god. They're brown, they are Muslim, they are Arab, they come from the south. They don't matter as much as European children. These are states that were either built on genocide or where genocide is an intrinsic component of their national identity.
When we consider the ongoing slaughter that is Gaza and the West's complicity, it's not the world leaders, East or West, who have captured our collective imagination. It's the ordinary people who have made the difference. It's the journalists, the poets, the doctors and nurses that have helped the world see the atrocities of settler colonialism and its abject violence. Certainly, a diffused media has given the world, possibly for the very first time, the ability to witness the horrors of Israel. But it is people like my guest today who have been able to articulate a narrative that rises above the deliberate propaganda that passes as political commentary. Professor Ghassan Abu Sitta is a multi-award-winning plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He has worked in multiple war zones, including Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Gaza. He was, until recently, working to save lives in Gaza's war-ravaged and ill-equipped hospitals. Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Alaikum salam, and thank you very much for your kind invitation.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us, Dr. Ghassan. On the 7th of October, you were sitting in your home in London. 2 days later, you were on the border of Gaza and Egypt. What motivated you to move from relative comfort here in the UK to a war zone?
I think by the middle of the day, on Saturday the 7th, I realized that what was coming to Gaza was going to be absolutely horrendous. But even then, I thought this is going to be a worse version of the 2014 war, which had until then been the worst war Israel had waged on Gaza. Mm. But nothing compared to what has happened. Around 5 or 6 o'clock, my wife and I had a conversation that we've had in multiple wars where we agreed that the right thing to do is for me to go. And then I got in touch with MSF, my contact at the Middle East cell at MSF. And we discussed the need to go, the problems of getting a team through the other crossing, which is Erez, which was right in the middle of the clashes, and that my ability to get through Rafah from Egypt would be ideal. By Sunday morning, I had my tickets. At 3 o'clock, I took the flight to Cairo. And then overnight, Sunday night into Monday morning, I traveled through the Sinai Desert to Rafah Crossing.
At the very beginning of my introduction, I probably used a pejorative term, ordinary people. I mean, you've done something that's probably extraordinary. I mean, I was still processing what was happening in Gaza on the 7th of October. Yet you had made a move to a war zone. Why? Why, Abu Ghassan?
As a Palestinian, as the son of a family that became refugees in the Gaza Strip in 48. For me, Gaza was always the closest thing to home. Even though I'd grown up in Kuwait, was born in Kuwait, my father had moved to Kuwait in the 50s with that generation of Palestinians that went to the Gulf. Gaza was always home. And it was always a place that I had almost my parallel career in war surgery had evolved. As a medical student, I had gone as a volunteer to Gaza during the first intifada. As a junior surgeon, I'd gone during the second intifada. And as my career progressed, I'd gone to Gaza for the different wars. 2009, 2012, 2014, 2021, the marches of return on the day the Americans moved their embassy. And so, and my wife comes from there. My children believe that this is their home. And so that was, for me, the natural thing to do, even though I'd been to other wars.
Yeah,
I'd also been working for the previous couple of years on a project to set up a training program for plastic surgeons in Gaza with one of the British medical charities. And therefore, I had a very good understanding of what the capabilities in the system were and what the shortfalls were. And I felt that my skills would be an added value if I would go.
I would like to discuss your experiences when you were there in Gaza, but you were there for 43 days. Gaza today, of course, has gone through a tumultuous time. How have you left Gaza? What is the state of Gaza today?
So the reason I left was that this medical and the health system had been so damaged and so destroyed that when I finally got to the southern part of Gaza in the last 2 days of the war, I discovered that even though the hospitals had not yet been targeted, and they have since, the shortage of material, the shortage of medication meant that really there was no relative shortage of surgeons. Actually, there was a surplus of surgeons because the system had shrunk to the point where you had people waiting around trying to take their patients to the operating rooms, but the operating rooms were not enough of them, and there wasn't the material to do the majority of the surgeries. And so that health system, since I left, what the Israelis did in the north, which is systematically destroy one hospital after the other, has been happening in the south. They've destroyed Shuhada al-Aqsa Hospital, which is in the central zone. They're now targeting Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. And they're moving from one hospital to the other as part of the same central tenet of the Israeli war, which is the destruction of the health system as a way of making Gaza uninhabitable so that in the ceasefire that would follow, the ethnic cleansing would continue. And the Israelis are already touting this idea of voluntary transfer of Palestinians, as if watching your children die of wounds would constitute a voluntary exit if you were decided to leave Gaza to seek treatment for your family members. And that's what the Israelis want to do.
So, Ghassan, you were initially posted to Al-Ahli Hospital in the northern part of Gaza. And then the war begins, or the so-called war begins. What did you witness in those early days?
So my first arrival on the Tuesday, and I had gotten in on Monday, but we were pinned down in a house for that day from the bombing.
Right.
I arrived at Shifa Hospital.
Okay.
Shifa has a burns unit, that's where the department that I was working on training with existed. And I stayed there until the numbers of patients were so overwhelming to the system that we were having patients who are waiting for weeks to go to surgery. And so the decision was made between myself and my colleagues that let me try to use some of the other hospitals and take some patients away from Shifa Hospital to operate. And that was really the first day that I went to Al-Ahli Hospital. And that was the 17th of October, the day of the massacre, at Al Ahli Hospital. I arrived that morning, and by the evening, that hospital was targeted with a missile.
Yeah. There's been a lot of discussion about the deliberate targeting of hospitals. Israel continues to pursue the line that there is no targeting of health facilities in either the north or the south. You say that there is a deliberate policy of degrading the health services in Gaza generally. Why? Why would Israel do that?
I think the stated aim, and one of the bizarre things about this war, is how open Israeli leaders, military and political leaders, have been about their genocidal intent, about ethnic cleansing of Gaza, emptying Gaza. One of them said, this is Nakba part two. All of these open admissions, driven by 75 years of Western impunity, means that the Israelis want to make Gaza uninhabitable. And one of the main ways you can make a place uninhabitable is by completely destroying the health system. Mm-hmm. And so they haven't just destroyed the health system by one single means, i.e. bombing, surrounding. They have attacked them in multiple ways. They have bombed them. They have sent quadcopter sniper drones to fire into patients. They have killed over 300 doctors, nurses, and ambulance staff. In those hospitals that were destroyed and evacuated once the Israelis land invasion happened, they dynamited these hospitals. Mm. Those hospitals that reopened in the north in an attempt to treat patients were then attacked. They were surrounded, snipers fired into these hospitals, and then Israeli soldiers went in and arrested some of the doctors. And they used fuel as a way of cutting electricity out from these hospitals. Mm. They targeted the solar panels on top of these hospitals to make sure that they're completely dependent on fuel. And so there was a kind of systematic dismantling of the health system rather than just single attacks on each facility. And what happened in the north has happened in the south and will continue because it's a central tenet of this hospital, of this war, the destruction of the health system.
Right.
We are also seeing the other component of the destruction of the health system, which is, and this is again, I mean, this is the bizarre thing. This is Israeli politicians have admitted wanting to do this, which is the spread of epidemics. Today, the Ministry of Health has announced that there is an outbreak of hepatitis A. We have had outbreaks of diarrheal diseases, of respiratory diseases. Cholera and typhus are just around the corner, because there is no health facilities. The water and sewage systems have been destroyed. People are living in cramped accommodation in schools that have been now occupied by tens of thousands of internally displaced families. Yeah. People are malnourished, and so their immune system is down. So all of this perfect storm is almost like a medieval attempt through starvation and epidemics to wipe out the population. Where the bombs and the bullets don't get you, the disease will surely get you.
We hear and we know that the majority of the victims are children. Children have died in disproportionate numbers during this war or this slaughter. Can you describe the types of injuries you saw in those children?
So, according to UNICEF, around 5,000 have had amputations. From my own experience, the majority have had multiple limbs amputated. We know from the medical literature that a child with a war-related amputation will end up with between 9 and 12 surgeries by the time they reach adult age. They need each prosthetic changed every 6 months as they grow. We have seen children with major burns, over 40% of their bodies burned. There are some incendiary bombs that the Israelis have used. And we've, you know, at one stage early on in the war, we had over 100 patients at Shifa Hospital with more than 40% body surface area burn. Shrapnel, regular shrapnel from explosives, kids taken out from buildings that have collapsed on top of them. Special explosives like the one used at Ahli Hospital, which is a Hellfire drone. That is a fragmentation drone. The casing of the drone disintegrates into discs that causes multiple injuries against individuals.
Describe how that works, the Hellfire drone.
So it explodes at the very surface of impact. So rather than burrow in, which means that when it does explode, the design of the casing means that the casing then becomes these discs. And it produces very characteristic injuries where the amputations are in high part, you know, in the middle of the thigh, where you don't expect the amputations to happen, because with regular explosions, the amputations happen in the weaker part of the bodies around the joints, where this mid-thigh, mid-arm. And multiple shrapnels and numbers of, you know, the wounded is staggering. Not just at Al Ahli, where they killed 480 of the families that were taking refuge in the hospital, but I remember towards the end they targeted a mosque where families had been taking refuge with a similar missile, and everybody came in with shrapnel, and we were taking that pieces of metal out of their bodies. On that night, I did amputations on 6 kids. The numbers are just staggering. The ability of that weapon to cause destruction, and then we started, as I said, seeing quadcopters being employed, and these are drones that have sniper guns, and they are used against hospital in that they are deployed in the areas leading to the hospital, and so patients that are trying to get there or families trying to get to these hospitals are fired on, and we see these high velocity gunshot wounds from the snipers. And we, you know, I remember a child and his mother, he passed away. She had a chest injury. And one day we had 20 of these quadcopter gunshot wounds coming in. The full range of armament, and I believe some of them experimental, some of them as grotesque as it sounds, as part of the marketing of Israeli-made weapons. And as the Israeli manufacturing weapons manufacturers say, battle-tested, when they want to tell their clients that this has been used on Gaza and they can see the injuries. We can see we can see new weapons being used as a way of, you know, as a way of marketing these weapons.
Can you expand on or explain the types of weapons that cause the burns that you witnessed in your medical rounds?
So at the beginning, we were seeing major burns with no shrapnel. So major burns as in the depth and the surface area. My feeling that these were incendiary bombs that create a fireball that engulfs the patient and the victim. But soon after, we started seeing white phosphorus. White phosphorus I'd seen in Gaza in 2009, and it has a very characteristic burn because it's a chemical burn, and it kind of burns right into the body.
Yeah. How far does it go?
It keeps going until it is no longer exposed to oxygen, and then it goes off. And so I was taking it from, you know, the remnant of the pellets from around the bone, around the ribs, you know. It burns right through, and it continues to burn. You have to cut it out rather than it douse it out.
You've been in multiple war zones previously. You were in Syria, Iraq, Yemen. You also experienced the previous wars in Gaza, 2009, 2012, 2014. How did your experience measure up or compare to those war zones that you've experienced previously?
I think it's the difference between a flood and a tsunami. Really? The magnitude, the scale, the intensity, the fact that the health system is a central component of the military strategy, the amount of destruction. In 2014 war, the Israelis used to target buildings. In this war, the Israelis would target whole neighborhoods. You'd see the whole neighborhood basically just go up in flames and then a ball of dust, and then the whole neighborhood would disappear. And we then discovered that the United States had been supplying Israel with these 2,000-pound bombs that are capable, when you drop six or seven of them in the same neighborhood, of taking out the whole neighborhood. And that's why there's over 10,000 people missing in Gaza, believed still buried under the rubble. There isn't the heavy lifting equipment to take out these. And this is fueling the public health catastrophe. As the rain comes in, as the war drags on, these bodies disintegrate, and they become part of the fuel of the epidemics, because they seep into the drinking water, they get everywhere. And the magnitude of viciousness is incomprehensible even when you see it yourself.
Really?
The killing machine, the diabolical killing machine that has been unleashed and continues to be unleashed on people in Gaza on multiple levels, even as you see it happening in front of you, your mind refuses to accept what's happening.
Yeah. Ghassan, one of the, visually we saw a tremendous resilience in the Gaza people, and we continue to see that. You experienced that firsthand. Can you describe that to our viewers, please?
It's always been inspiring. One of the reasons why I've always gone back to Gaza, not just as a Palestinian, a lot of the colleagues of mine who are not Palestinian or Western doctors who continue to go back to Gaza for 20 years and 30 years explain the same thing, that steadfastness, which is when staying alive, embracing life, becomes an act of resistance against this death machine. And you watch it amongst your colleagues who continue to serve, even though many of them have had devastating personal loss as a result of this war. And you see it in the patients. And a lot of it is driven by faith. Deep, deep faith about, what we call in Islam al-ihtisab. Ihtisab is a concept in Sharia that if you are able to tolerate these assaults on you and your life because you believe that God is testing you, that this steadfastness is part of, is a form of prayer, is a form of ibadah. And also that faith keeps people, their belief that this is part of God's work, and that, that even if God's creatures will not come to their aid, eventually God will, through his mercy, come to their aid.
Yeah. You must have made really strong relationships with the doctors and nurses at the hospitals that you worked in. Can you describe again, you must have an extra level of resilience to be a medical professional in these war zones, and particularly in Gaza. Just describe their mindset that you experience on a daily basis.
I mean, I'll give you an example of a colleague of mine and a friend of mine, Dr. Mohammed Abed. So Dr. Abed is an orthopedic surgeon. We started out in this war. He was based at one of the hospitals in Jabalia camp in the north. We worked together when I moved to Jabalia Hospital, to Al-Awda Hospital in Jabalia. When that hospital was threatened by the Israelis, we relocated the limb reconstruction work that we were doing back to Shifa Hospital. We worked together at Shifa. When the Israelis surrounded Shifa, he opted to stay with his patients. And so they were cut off for over 12 days with snipers shooting into the hospital. When the Israelis finally allowed the patients and the staff to leave, he went back to the north, worked in the Indonesian hospital. When the Israeli artillery bombed the Indonesian hospital and the hospital ceased to function, he moved to Lauda Hospital, which is down the road in Jabalia. Then Israeli snipers surrounded that hospital and started firing into him, and he was wounded by an Israeli sniper. Luckily, he wasn't killed. A week later, he was operating again, and he's operating at the moment at Lauda Hospital, despite all of this. Another colleague of mine who was born in Dublin and has a Irish passport, was at Shifa Hospital, remained with his patients throughout the siege of Shifa, then moved to the European hospital, and now is at the European hospital in Rafah, working with his patients, refusing to leave, even though he has the ability to leave. And so one is in awe of their sense of duty that they have towards their community. And you see these young final year medical students who have, you know, stepped up and are acting as fully fledged doctors in the emergency departments. As much as Israel has singled out the health system for its attack, the health system has singled itself out as a main form of resistance against the Israeli war. And the nurses and the doctors have paid a heavy price. Over 300 doctors and nurses have been killed. Over 40 have been arrested by the Israelis. And we will soon enough start watching show trials of doctors, because that's why the Israelis have arrested them and are torturing them. There has been reports from some of the people who had been released from these jails that the Israelis are targeting the doctors that they have for extra torture and mistreatment. And so all of this battle between life and the Israeli death machine, at the forefront are the health professionals in Gaza.
Ghassan Abusita, you are an eyewitness to what can only be described as a genocide, yet the West remains largely silent to the cries of Gaza. What lay behind that? Why are they so duplicitous, I think is the term you used previously. Why are they so duplicitous in their dealings with what is a horrendous slaughter?
So, obviously, this war has highlighted a major crisis in Western democracy. Mm. I mean, the streets around us, where we are now on Saturday, were filled with hundreds of thousands of people calling for an end to this war, voicing their support for the Palestinian people. Yeah. And similar demonstrations were happening across the whole globe. So obviously, as we saw during the Iraq war, the crisis of democracy, where it's the ruling elite in the West that is silencing or attempting to silence voices that are against the war and are thwarting the will of the people. And so when the government and the leadership of the Labour Party take positions that are diametrically opposed to the will of the British people, and similar things happen everywhere else in Europe, I think it's not the West, but it's the Western elite who have, have made a decision to completely disregard the democratic will of people. Mm. So that's one part. And then there's another part. And this is, this is something that we have to openly talk about. And there are genocidal states. I mean, I don't expect Canada to be opposed to genocide when it was burying native children in the schoolyard a few decades ago.
Yeah.
I don't expect the United States to think genocide of natives is a bad idea. Mm. I don't expect Germany to think genocide is a bad idea. I mean, these are states that were either built on genocide or where genocide is an intrinsic component of their national identity.
I mean, that's really, really interesting, because we were taught to believe that these states have moved on, the end of history. You know, we've now got the character of these states are liberal and democratic, and human rights becomes a cornerstone of the international architecture. Yet despite all of this, we see a hunger, actually, to protect and defend Israel. The ICJ, Germany, put forward a case defending Israel against the label of genocide. How do we, I suppose, how do we navigate what we see in the textbooks versus what we see in reality?
I think, again, it has to be that we see through the economic interests of the ruling classes in these countries. Mm. You know, there's a reason why the British government continues to give export licenses to British manufacturers. There is a reason why Germany has announced that it will be sending 10,000 tank shells to the Israeli army, because that makes money.
Yeah.
There's a reason why American interests in using Israel to police the Middle East and ensure the compliance or the cowering of Arab governments in the region through this ogre that the Americans and the West has fostered.
Yeah.
And so these are political elites that have used Israel and continue to use Israel as a weapon against the interests of people in the South, particularly in the Middle East. What is interesting is that this world is coming to an end, and where countries like South Africa are able to set the agenda for international justice, where Namibia stands up to the Germans and reminds them of not only the fact that they wiped out 80% of Namibia's population, but that they never acknowledged properly the way they did with the Holocaust, because these were Africans and therefore not deserving of the same kind of acknowledgement and repentance that European Jews were entitled to. Mm-hmm. And so we see a shifting world where the real international community, the Brazilians and the Indians and the Pakistanis and the Africans and the Chinese are the international community, and not a handful of European countries and North American countries.
And do you think there's a racial component here? I mean, we witness the embrace of the Ukrainian struggle. Their refugees were embraced. You know, their struggle was embraced. Maybe because they were white and Europeans, but there is a sense of, you know, almost a dehumanizing of the Gazans in the Western press. I mean, have I gone too far there, or do you agree?
No. I mean, at the end of the day, we have to ask a question. Had the Israelis killed 10,000 French or Swiss or Ukrainian or British children, would the reaction have been the same? And so the question is, so it's not the same. Is the world now accepting of the idea that you can kill 10,000 kids, 1% of the population, and get away with it? Or is it that it's the wrong kind of kids and therefore it's okay? That is an acceptable victim. And because the Ukraine war came so close before this war in Gaza, you can compare the outrage and the moral indignation at the deaths in Ukraine versus the lack of any moral outrage at the multitude of you know, larger figures in the Gaza Strip. It is because they are the children of a lesser God. They, you know, they're brown, they are Muslim, they are Arab, they come from the south. They don't matter as much as European children do. And that's that. We then need to kind of step back, and as painful as it is, because the slaughter is continuing, you need, the West needs to understand that blood on this magnitude rewrites history, and that the world will not be the same after this war as it was before. And the relationship between Muslim nations and Arab nations and the West will not be the same. I'm not talking about, you know, extremist groups that no, I'm talking about a much more fundamental erosion of that and a chasm between, that will grow between the two places, mm-hmm. where not just Palestinians, but Palestinians, Egyptians, Pakistanis, Indians, Africans will ask, if you think so little of Palestinian children, then you think so little of my children. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we do not share the same world as you. And so this blind support that Western governments have given to Israel's killing machine, there will be a reckoning, and there will be historical consequences for it.
Were you surprised at the response of the UK Labour Party to this crisis? Keir Starmer, David Lammy, you know, two lawyers, human rights background. They've always fought the good fight against oppression, yet they've been squarely behind the state of Israel, probably more so than the Conservative Party, in at least tonally. Of course, in actuality, the same, but tonally, they gave more support to the Israeli killing machine. Did that surprise you in any way?
I think we have been, the kind of the coup at the leadership of the Labour Party that brought these two to the leadership was instigated to a large degree by the Israeli embassy. We've seen the Al Jazeera documentaries and the Jazeera papers linking the Israeli embassy to what happened and how they were brought to power or brought to leadership by them. But they represent the essence of the democratic crisis that we live in as citizens in this country, where these elites have manipulated the democratic process to the point where people do not have real democratic alternatives. And that's the crisis that everybody is going to face in the next election. There's nothing ideologically or in terms of policy that differentiates the Labour and Conservative parties. And what politicians don't understand, and their slick advisors fail to tell them, that people, you see, the accepted wisdom in politics, in Western politics, is that people never vote on foreign policy.
Yeah,
but actually, the erosion of respect based on moral decisions do affect people's choice. Mm. People vote for politicians they can trust, and people will not trust these politicians because of the moral choices that they face.
Yeah.
You can't vote for someone whom you find morally nauseating.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I've been somewhat involved in the Muslim vote campaign around the country. I don't know if you may have picked this up. In the last few days, the constituency of Ilford North have selected an independent candidate, a young, articulate Palestinian woman, to stand against West Streeting. It seems like that's the first of probably many constituencies that may go in such a direction. What's your reflections on where the Muslim vote may go in this coming year?
I mean, I think it is of paramount importance that we as Muslim citizens of this country make those politicians who supported this war, because this is not a war, this is a genocide, this is an attempt to wipe out a group of Muslims who live somewhere not very far.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that we make an example out of them in the next election.
Yeah.
So that it never happens again. So that any career-minded politician in the UK supporting a similar war in the future thinks twice about what would happen to their career if they were to go down that road. We need to use the Muslim vote, and the people need to make sure that they look at the how their MP voted in the ceasefire vote in Parliament, and what statements they made. Political activists need to make that information available to Muslim families and voters when the time comes to vote.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Ghassan, I've met Muslims now in multiple cities, and I've made exactly that case that we can't allow those who advocate for genocide, we can't allow them our vote. We can't give them our vote in the next election, and we have to try to undermine that vote as much as possible. I think the vast majority of Muslim voters of all backgrounds tend to agree with that. But I do get maybe 10%, a minority, but a sizable minority of Muslims who say, that's true. They have done what they've done, but we have other interests. And, one needs to balance those interests, local interests, the planning permission on my local mosque or community center. I just heard the other day from a community group in High Wycombe, which is one of the probably 40 most important constituencies when it comes to the coming vote in terms of Muslims. And I heard from one constituency within that constituency, if you may, who are telling their congregants within the mosque to vote Labour because it will give them, Labour will give them some special privileges, maybe a planning permission or whatever it may be. I mean, how do you respond to that type of, that level of argument?
I think at the essence, people need to understand that this is a genocidal decision.
Yeah.
These are political parties who found it acceptable to support the wiping out of a group of Muslims. And therefore, even if in the short term they will throw some crumbs, at the essence of their soul, they do not see your children as worthy of life. And that's the question that you need to ask, and we need to ask in the future, that these politicians will do to us here what they have allowed to be done to our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
Yeah.
Because they don't see us or our children as human or as equally human.
Thank you. And one final question. I come across a lot of young medical students, young Muslim medical students, really talented individuals. What advice would you give to them as they start their medical career? How do they make a real difference in the world, in their lives ahead?
I think you need to now make a decision about what kind of health professional you want to be. And it's not related to specialization, but it's related to the essence. Do you believe that health is a commodity? Do you believe that corporations, by their very essence, are anti-human and anti-social entities and therefore inconsistent with health?
Yeah.
And then if you do that, then you... ask yourself, why did I choose this profession? And if the answers are that you chose this profession because you want to make a difference, then you chart a life and a professional life where you do make a difference.
Right.
to the lives of others through health. You are very fortunate that it is the profession that brings you into the lives of others in a way no other profession does. People let you into their lives and still trust you. And you have a moral duty to serve their interests. Here and abroad, in a way that is ethical and moral.
Actually, one real final question. The last 3 months must have had a major toll on you and your, I suspect you're still processing the enormity of the 43 days in Gaza. How do you stay grounded and stay resilient? Because, mashallah, alhamdulillah, you've managed to come back and do the rounds in the media and speak to as many people as possible, as you are doing today. It must be a really difficult time for you.
My heart is still in Gaza. My thoughts are with my patients and with my colleagues. And the only way I can accept the decision to leave is so that I can be their voice on the outside and fight the fight for them. Yeah. As a doctor, I have a duty of care. And that duty of care is to ensure that my patients get the treatment that they need and they get the justice that they deserve. And that's how I can accept the fact that I am outside Gaza while this massacre continues to happen.
Will we see justice?
I think eventually we will see justice.
Yeah.
I think we've never thought in our lifetime that we would see Israel's name associated with genocide in the International Court of Justice. Mm. I was speaking to someone of a similar age to me the other day and saying, having been in this country since the 80s, if I had told you at the time of P.W. Botha in the 80s that South African men and women lawyers will be out taking on Israel in defense of Palestine, mm-hmm. you'd think that I was absolutely hallucinating. But it did happen. In our lifetime, we not only saw freedom in South Africa, but we saw South Africa try to defend the right of Palestinians for that freedom. And that, for me, is what gives me hope. Martin Luther King says, the arc of freedom is long, but it does bend towards freedom, or the arc of history is long, but it bends towards freedom. And I hope that, the struggle is going to be long, that this is a genocidal conclusion to the logic of settler colonialism, which is predicated on the elimination of the native. But at the same time, 75 years on, we are still here. The struggle continues for our humanity. And the world now sees Israel the way we have seen it for the last 75 years.
Yes. Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkingmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.